Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we're going to be talking about survival. Do you think you can survive in the wilderness? What about if you're out there by yourself and you're going, hey, what does the wilderness mean? My backyard? Does that mean in the woods? Does that mean down by the beach? Or does that mean on top of a mountain? Or does that mean in the center city? Ah, yes, all these types of survival. And I think, you know, if you take someone from that grew up in the mountains and we put them in the city, we say, hey, that city is their wilderness. They don't even know what to do there. We take people from the city, we put them out in the woods, and they're like, oh my gosh, what is going on? So let's really talk about that today. I myself have spoken many times on here that I stayed for Hurricane Katrina and many other hurricanes after that. Hey, you know, if you've done the big one, you say, ah, it didn't take me out. What's the point? I can do some more. And you just kind of like sit there like a, you know, a duck, and you're just saying, ah, it's not going to take me out. I'm good to go. And one day I think that's going to prove me wrong. But we talk about hurricanes and we say, ah, that's another wilderness too. I need to know how to survive. We look at snowstorms. We look at mass floodings. We look at everything that's going on around us and we say, oh, I went on a hiking trip and it was all good. Yeah, it was great. You had a lot of people with you. You had your cell phone. It still worked. Isn't that great? Let's talk about how to survive these days. My guest today is Craig Caudill, and again, his book is Extreme Wilderness Survival. What he's going to be talking about today is how to share and survive any outdoor situation, short-term or long-term, that's important, with or without gear, absolutely, because we'll find out what gear means, and alone or with others. We never know what will happen. Craig, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Always good to talk to you, and look forward to hopefully assisting someone and make sure they're a little bit more safer when they're in the wilderness.
Absolutely. Well, Craig, you know, I think I've been in enough of these places myself where we can have a great conversation on, you know, all of these things that come up, living in, you know, when it was snowing in the Poconos, we know those risks. We know the risks when we're in Florida or in Louisiana with hurricanes and tornadoes. And we can always say, what does a wilderness mean? So can you share right from the get-go, what does extreme wilderness actually mean? Because so many people will say, oh, gosh, that's those people that are way out in the boonies, you know, and they all look like they got all their camouflage on and they're good to go, right? And I think we all find ourselves unexpectedly sometimes in places that we can call our wilderness.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right earlier when you said that a wilderness is basically where you have gone into an area that you're unfamiliar. So you can take a mountain boy and put him in the middle of New York City, and that would be a wilderness of sorts. Now, my book in particular was focused on a forested landscape, wilderness survival in that regard. So that was the focus of that particular text. So that's when I focused my attention in the book, that's what it was all about, was how to develop your ability to survive, prepare your mindset, your skills, your tactics, and your gear in such a way that if you find yourself in the wilderness, you're okay. And what I meant by that is not necessarily, hey, you go hiking and you get lost or something of that nature. A lot of the situations in the book, each chapter starts off with a story from real life, not a made-up story, but a real-life story where someone has perished in a wilderness. Mm-hmm. And I put together about 200 different stories when I was doing research for the book, and just to see how people came about with tragedy. And the vast multitude of them, well over half of them, somewhere around 62 to 63% of them, were due to some sort of navigational error or error in GPS or some variation thereof. And some of those were people that were not necessarily going to a wilderness. They were just drawing from one place to another, happened to be in a wilderness when, for example, their TomTom took them down a road that went the wrong direction.
Right.
And something happened. So in a couple of the stories were just business people that were traveling from one office to another of their organization and found themselves in a rural wilderness type setting, and something happened, whether it was a wreck or a flat tire or again, GPS that took them the wrong direction, and it led to some sort of tragedy.
You know, I think we have become so dependent upon technology these days, we've become lazy. We have become overly dependent on technology. I always liken it to, I think whenever you move to a certain area, you go on vacation in a certain area, or if you are going on a trip somewhere in a certain area, I always think of, you know, you used to have the old-time paper maps. You knew how you got there, the terrain. You knew if you went over mountains, if you saw rivers. You know if there was some fast food. You knew if there were signs along the way where you would be able to get some help. You knew if there was a hotel or a hospital. Kind of as parents, I think, and as you know, a really great traveler myself, I think I've just learned all those techniques along the way because we didn't have cell phones to say, hey, if I decide to go to this park and I know my kid is an asthmatic, I need to know how far away is there a hospital. We can't just Google it and find it, you know. But we've become so dependent upon these dang phones that we just say, oh, they'll always work. I'll go in the woods with my phone. Oh, it will always work. And it doesn't even always have the answers. And it can really set you awry sometimes, you know, that GPS, you know, many times, you know, I've said to my daughter, she says, oh, I've got it on my phone. I don't need the address. Just give me the point and I'm good to go. You know, and she says, oh, I ended up in some pretty shady places that I shouldn't have been. And, you know, we think about that. You know, I think the most important thing of your entire book, again, the book we're talking about today with Craig is Extreme Wilderness Survival, is the very first two pages. And you're sitting with a tree, and the chapter, it says mindset development. And what that means to me is you best sit, eat, and breathe, and know who you are and where you are and be able to know your surroundings. I think so many people, they go outside. I know I've done this before. I said to somebody, we were traveling downtown, and we only went like about a mile, and we stopped for gas. And I said, oh, my gosh, did you see all of that stuff from here to there? And they're like, what are you talking about? You know, and they saw zero. But what I saw was the canals were really high on one side, and why was it really low on the other? And I noticed all the pelicans, they weren't out in the morning like they usually are. And then I noticed that a lady was crying in her car at the gas station. Then I noticed, hey, that guy over there, he needs some air in his tires. It was boom, boom, boom. I noticed my terrain. I knew what was going on. I had a sense that something else was changing, and I kind of paid attention. And I think that's number one key in anything is pay attention, know who you are and where you are, and settle into that immediately. Don't you think it's like that drop-in moment? Whoa, stand still, assess the situation.
Yeah, without a doubt, I agree with you what you're saying. The first five chapters of the book are on mindset, and the first one that you're alluding to there is on systems of survival. And the way we teach survival in our school, which is basically the format that I presented in my book, is a military focus of on mindset,
right,
or system of survival, which is, you know, STOPA and the law of threes. And STOPA meaning, in any related event, unless somebody's trying to bring harm to you, you do the acronym STOPA: stop, think, observe, plan, and act. And I go into great detail about what each one of those means, and as well as the law of threes. You can't live more than 3 minutes without blood flow and oxygen flow. You can't live more than 3 hours without maintaining your core body temp. Can't live more than 3 days without water. Can't live more than 3 weeks without food. Can't live more than 3 months without human companionship. And so that, in a nutshell, is what I go through in the whole book, because we've got to have we must have a system. And it must be a system that is simplistic to be able to work it under stress. What most people do is that we practice these survival skills, or And it's almost become a hobby of sorts where you play and you basically do an extended camping trip or something of that nature. But people don't actually put themselves under stress and try to do the same things. Like, for example, you've broken an arm, you twisted an ankle, or you can't see, or it's in the dark instead of, you know, with full sunlight and you've got mm-hmm. flashlights and all that. I mean, these are all stressors that when added to any particular scenario outside makes it more difficult to do unless you spend a lot of time practicing, unless you know how to develop your mindset. And so what I wanted to do in that chapter that you speak of is just help mm-hmm. people know, here's a simple system. You know, I call it kiss it, like a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. Keep it simple, stupid, right? Just keep it simple so that in any related event, it doesn't matter if it's a wilderness event and you've gone hiking or you wrecked your car, or you can apply this in an urban situation as well, you know that you should stop, think, observe, plan, and act out your survival situation and take care of yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's always, if you can do it under a certain pattern, you can like learn something. It's almost like kids learning their ABCs. Even if they're scared, even if they're stage fright, they could say their ABCs. Even if they're out anywhere, they could say their ABCs. In other words, get that as a rote part of your brain focus so that mm-hmm. that tape can just, you know, play on its own pretty much and guide you through something even when stress is barking at it. You know, sometimes we think of stress, someone sees a rattlesnake and the first thing they do is scream, and it's probably not the first thing you want to do, you know. Or you think about scorpions, when I lived in Arizona, scorpions in my house, and it was like, oh my God, look at the scorpion, and I ran away, which was really stupid because once I ran away, the scorpion ran too, but then I had to search for the scorpion. So, you know, I would have been better to take care of the scorpion in the first place rather than screaming and running away and then having to look for it. So we have to think about, you know, different things in our minds about, you know, how we can be okay in this system. I think the biggest thing is that society has taught us to be afraid of everything and to run, and that everybody else will take care of it, you know, instead of what you're teaching in the book is, number one, you're here, there is no running. Number two, there is no one else to take care of it. So this is this is really the first half of your book, and the second half, you need to take care of it and you can't run. So that's really the basic and I think the most best focus you can put in your head at all times. And it's not always to have a backup system all the time, because backups fail. You know, I lived in, you know, Hurricane Katrina and all the other hurricanes. Backups fail. And they fail. When they fail in the first 5 minutes of a great storm that's going to last for weeks. You know, so I've been down to backups fail. So you got to have the system that you know, if this goes down, this comes up. This goes down, this comes up, you know, and you'll be able to work through it, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely. And that's why these systems are always built upon some sort of, you know, these backups and contingencies that you need to be okay when things don't go right. You know, one of the chapters in my book is all about how to handle stress, how to handle awareness. You were mentioning about seeing the canals at different levels. You know, developing an awareness so you know what's going on around you at different times is difficult. Now, we say that that's important, and a lot of instructors will talk about how important that is. They don't teach people how to develop their awareness. And that's exactly what I did in the book, as well as, you know, any number of things of awareness, how to set your ego aside, how to handle stresses. And what we did is I've been teaching a large number of military personnel over the last few years and as a private contractor. And one of the things that's come out of that training is I get to sit around campfires with all these really special guys and gals that have a considerable amount of training over and above what I was offering, and hear, you know, how do you handle stress? And so, you know, battlefield stress is pretty stressful. You know, people are dying on a regular basis, and people are trying to kill you on a regular basis, and there's not much in the world that's as stressful as that. So there's ways to handle that stress, and I was able to take their words and put them in modern-day English outside of, you know, battlefield stress. And that's another thing that we've shared there in those first five chapters is how to handle stress in and of itself, because it is vital for you to be able to do that, because when you're stressed, your blood pressure rises, you have an adrenaline dump, you have auditory exclusion, your vision goes to tunnel vision. And when you're in that position, your body's physiologically like that. You cannot physically make good decisions. So that's why we wanted to teach people to be in a position where they can make those appropriate decisions.
You know, well, it was just funny when you just said that, because I almost think of stress as putting a lock on the file cabinet. Do you know how when they say, you know how when you see on these movies and stuff, you know, and there's the sound is going off like a security breach or whatever, and all of the doors come down and they're making a big alarm and all these things start to go into lockdown mode? Well, I always call stress as your lockdown mode. So if you've got that tape in your brain that's going to play out and tell you how to survive this thing, if you're stressed, you're in lockdown mode. That file cabinet's locked. It's not opening up. You've got to be able to let that be open, or you will never be able to serve that. You know, I always think about stress, too. When people say, what is it? You know, and I always say to them, you know, stress is an uncomfortable feeling to something, period. That's it. You know, we try to give it all these fancy descriptions and all of these other things. It's this, it's that. Dude, it's like, ooh, I walked outside. Oh, it's hot outside. I'm stressed. I'm afraid of the sunburn. My blood pressure's going to go up. I don't want to go out. I want to go back in my comfort. So stress is any, you know, that feeling outside of anything else, you know, outside of that comfort zone, period. And we can get that at any time. So to be able to learn techniques to be able to be less stressed, to leave that file cabinet open and not let your brain go in lockdown mode, will really allow you to access that information to be able to take care of yourself. You know, I remember after Hurricane Katrina, here was my number one thing I always told people for all storms going forward. The militia is not coming to save you.
Right.
And that's important, because even when you're in the woods, when you're in a flood, when you're in a fire, when you're wherever you might be, that first bit of your open files to how do you help yourself, the militia is not coming. If you think of that, you can take care of yourself for those first few minutes, those first few days, whatever you might need to do. But you need to know that, because if you stand there and just say, I'm going to stand here, they're going to come and get me, maybe not. Yes?
Right. Yeah, I agree 100%. And that's, you know, that's why I think, you know, we talk about that law of threes, and 3 minutes is where you've got to take care of your blood flow and oxygen flow. And usually we use that as a stepping stone to discuss wilderness first aid and stuff of that nature, and all the things that you need to do to make sure your body doesn't leak what right. needs to stay in it. But the big one that we also discuss, both in our classes as well as in the book, is your need for self-defense and personal safety training.
Yeah.
Whether that is, you know, defensive tactics, hand-to-hand combatives, or it's something where it's armed. I'm not necessarily a fan of offensive confrontation, because for the most part that's an illegal event. So, but I am a big fan of people being able to defend themselves and take care of those that they care about, whether that's an armed confrontation or an unarmed one. It doesn't matter to me. If somebody wants to bring harm to myself or my family, then I want to be able to defend myself. I'm not going to sit around and let people just take what doesn't belong to them, particularly in a large scale event. You need to be able to defend yourself. And sometimes, not to be too overt and, you know, I want to hurt people, because I don't. I've been teaching hand-to-hand combatives and things of that nature for over 20 years now, and I actually abhor the thought of violence. I'm not a fan of bringing violence on another person. But with that said, I'm also less of a fan of people hurting my family. So, you know, one way that you can keep yourself safe and not have to physically confront someone is to hide and be in a place where people can't see you and bring harm to you, if that's possible. You know, there's this old mindset, they're not necessarily old, but it's been put out a little bit more lately, is run, hide, fight in like an active shooter situation. And you run when you can, you hide when you can't run, and then when you can't run or hide, you fight. And
right.
There's a lot of people that carry guns, concealed carry, and stuff of that nature that are, you know, that's a weak-minded mindset. And I don't believe that. I disagree with that. I would rather avoid violence when I can. However, if I have to deliver violence in defense of myself or my family, I want to do it in an overwhelming fashion so that I'm the winner in that situation. So, you know, there's a rule of law in our country now, and I like it because we have the rule of law, and I love our law enforcement officers and what it is that they provide. But there are times, and Katrina was one of them, where the rule of law basically went out the window. And meaning, you know, for example, I trained a bunch of special response firefighters down in Memphis, and a bunch of those guys responded to Katrina. And at one point in time, they were literally stealing gasoline from the police department to run their engines.
Right.
And so they could get out and help people and find. I mean, the fire department was basically stealing gas from the police department. Now, that seems absurd to a lot of people that were not part of Katrina, but you understand what I'm talking about.
Right.
The rule of law, when it goes away, is an ugly, ugly part of the world to be in. And so, you know, simple defensive tactics measures, whether hand-to-hand or armed or something, that are vital in that situation.
Let's talk for a second about, you know, a lot of people will say they're doing a lot of this survival tactics. They're getting all of their survival food and their gear and stuff ready for, you know, what they feel might come down the pike or whatever, you know. And I would always say to them, it's always great that you have all this survival stuff, but, you know, you have to know how to use it, you have to practice through it, and you have to make sure it works. But what I can always remember from Hurricane Katrina was, you know, the idea is people have totally forgotten about this, and we tested it, and we know it's true, and no one else will speak about it or say that it is true. But the moment that an area is under a, quote, state of emergency, there are no laws. There's no laws whatsoever.
Right.
So what people have to understand, that you have to do what you need to do, period. So really,
right,
a lot of these people couldn't be prosecuted. A lot of other things couldn't happen. A lot of other things, it was really crazy. But because people learned, once a state of emergency is up and you're in an area, there are no laws. What does that mean? That means chemical plants can dump their chemicals in the water and they can't be held liable. Gas plants can let their toxins go into there. They're not held liable. People can steal from stores. They're not held liable. You can do whatever you need to do to be able to keep your people safe. You're not held liable. It is very true, and no one knows that. And once you know, something comes up, it's important to know that, because not always that you might be able to engage in whatever that might be, but also understand that those things are being engaged upon outside of you. So if you live next door to a chemical plant, you're saying, holy crap, maybe I need to not be here. Or if you're saying, I own that grocery store and, hey, I just need to give it up, they're going to ransack it, and not be trying to, quote, protect it. Or you could say that, you know, I need to go get food, whatever I need to do. So, and these things occur within, probably, I would say, within the first hour to two of an event.
Interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, right?
Right, exactly. No, that's incredibly interesting. You know, I wasn't there, so I love hearing what you folks have to say about it, because there's so much information that came out of there. That is valuable. There needs to be more written about it and talked about by people like you, which we appreciate you sharing that.
But also, too, what you share in your book is, if all of these things are in place, it is a source of surviving, so you are able to do it. Having weapons, that's important. Hey, look, in Texas, everybody carries. You know, you can carry there. You don't need a license, and it's open carry. You want to just, you know, go into McDonald's and set your gun on the counter, you can. So there are different states. So, again, going back to the beginning, what we said in this show is, know 100-mile radius where you are. What can occur?
Yeah.
What can happen? What's
going
to come down the pike? So I think it's great. We talked about the, you know, your mindset, and also about, you know, deciding what you want to do about your dangerous situation, and also about the potential of being able to physically and being armed. Let's talk for a second about your toolbox of survival things. You know, it just behooves me why these people can get away with it, but hey, they do. When these little boxes say first aid kit, and everybody says, I've got you, I've got one, I'm good to go. And it's like, oh my gosh, you could pitch that thing in the garbage. It means absolutely nothing. Have you found that?
I have found that to the point that it drives me absolutely insane.
Thank you.
So, we're big fans of pressure bandages, Israeli bandages, tourniquets, decomp needles, and MPAs and everything. But we have training to deal with those as well and know how to utilize them. And I think it's imperative that everybody have that sort of training and have those pieces of gear. For a wilderness kit, I'm not a fan of Band-Aids. I just tell people to take, four by four gauze and duct tape because it works better. And you can use it for, more than just what a Band-Aid would be used for. So, something as simple as that is vital for people. Yeah, but here's what, and this kind of alludes to something else you mentioned earlier, discussing a first aid kit really just gives us an opportunity to discuss it, and that is most people are just completely and wholly dependent upon the thought that some sort of gear is going to miraculously save them.
Yes.
And first aid kits are like that. And, you can get for example, you can go to any sporting goods store and get an outdoorsman's or a woodsman or outdoor first aid kit. And you think, it's got some extra stuff in it. Basically, it's going to have something like poison ivy rash ointment that's not going to work.
Yeah.
In addition to what is in the other kit.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic first aid kit. And it's mind-numbing that people don't take any – first aid classes for most companies are free. The company that offers first aid training at their location, you can get it for free. And even if you can't get it for free where you work, the Red Cross, American Heart Association, they offer very fundamental basic first aid classes for next to nothing. And companies like my own, we offer more advanced first aid training like wilderness and remote first aid training. And a lot of tactical organizations are offering, pretty much gunshot wound management, stuff of that nature. These are all things that, and I've said it a million times, if you're the type of person, if one of the listeners is the type of person that carries a weapon for self-defense and you don't carry a tourniquet, then forgive me for being direct, but you're a fool.
Yeah, if you don't know how to take care of that which you inflict.
Exactly. I am a huge fan of being able to, if you're going to be utilizing a weapon to defend yourself and you're trying to put holes in somebody, somebody's going to be trying to put holes in you, and they might just very well do it.
Right.
So if you don't know how to take care of yourself and those around you, then you're just, Colonel Jeff, this is another thing, and I'm going off on a tangent, but Colonel Jeff Cooper says we will not rise to the occasion, but rather we will default to our level of training.
Mm-hmm.
But most people strap on a gun, go about their business and think they're going to be okay, that they're going to rise to the occasion. They'll become, some Ranger Delta Snail sniper all of a sudden and be the best shot in the world, and everything's going to be just fine. Nobody's going to hit them. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
It's just not true. It's not how the real world works. We need to be able to, if you carry a gun, to defend yourself with it and know how to utilize it, maintain it, keep it safe, and at the same time, take care of yourself if you get shot. And at the least, carry a first aid kit because of motor vehicle accidents.
Mm-hmm,
a number of people bleed out due to, a large femoral brachial artery cut due to, a cut to the extremity that removes maybe an arm due to blood loss that would have been fixed if somebody could slap a tourniquet on them.
The seatbelts. Where the seatbelts ride on you, they're right there at that artery. All the thing needs to do is if you've got, sometimes these people have the clip up there, the plastic clip, all that needs to do is just pierce you right there and you've got a problem,
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you, it's crazy. Let's talk for a second about food and water. That just gets me. For Katrina, everybody ran to the stores, bought everything out, right? Filled up the refrigerators, filled up their ice chests. Okay, we filled it all up. made all the food, cooked it. Oh, we're good to go. We got enough food here for a week. We're not going anywhere. Within the first 10 minutes of the storm, the electricity went out, so did all the food. Everything was gone.
Right.
And they said, and you know when people say, but don't worry, the food stays in your refrigerator for at least 24 to 36 hours if you don't open it very much. That's, again, going back to the same thing we said in the beginning of this call. Know your radius. I live in a place where there's no air conditioning if the electricity goes out. It gets to be 120 in my house within an hour. So
Right. Guess
what? My refrigerator is defunct in 1 hour. So all of that went bad instantly. And it was like, okay, what do we do now? You know? And I think it's important to know when people are saying, oh, I threw a lot of bars in the back of my car. I'm good to go. You know, they're always there. But then, you know, at the games, the kids would eat them. And all of a sudden you look in the back and you say, I don't have that kit that I needed if I got stuck in the snow in the winter. So it's really also important to know what you're putting there, how it can be utilized, does it go bad or not, and also to at different times check it. Because when you have your survival kits, they can be frozen, they can be heated, they can be melted, they could go bad, they can deteriorate. And we don't even think of this. We say, I put it in there, I'm good to go, and you walk away, and, hey, that chapter's closed in your brain, right?
Right, exactly. And it doesn't work that way.
Right. So share a little about what you do about food and water.
Well, you know, as you've alluded to, anything that's going to be have a need to be refrigerated, you've got to have a solution for it. And here's what I recommend to everybody as far as a way of figuring this out, because it's, and then again, because it's a simple model and it works, is that at a prearranged time, turn the electric and water off to your house and keep it off for a week.
Yeah.
And then start writing notes on what comes up that's a problem.
Yeah.
And once you do that, here's what people that actually take my advice and do this, this is what happens. On day three, they've had enough.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? So they turn it back on. All right? So number one, they recognize that, hey, I'm not prepared mentally to deal with this.
Right.
And they've taken a few notes, and they probably have figured out the number of things that happen in, you know, 2 to 3 days. But, you know, make a goal of keeping it off for a week and then just keep dedicated notes. And everything that you come up with that is a problem, you need to find a solution for it. And so as far as food is concerned, you need to have food that you do not have to have refrigerated. And you need to store enough for whatever the most likely event is in your area, whether it's a hurricane down there. You know, up here we don't see hurricanes in Kentucky, mm-hmm. but an earthquake and or a tornado are real possibilities here. So we need to have, you know, a backup plan and a plan for dealing with those sorts of natural disasters. So, you know, people talk about MREs and backpacker meals and all that stuff, and I think there's a certain amount of value in those because they will add some variety, which also adds, which it helps with morale, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've trained a bunch of military personnel. One of the guys I trained a couple of years ago, he was in the very first invasion of Iraq, and he ate MREs 2 to 3 times a day for 6 months.
Yeah, they're disgusting.
And,
have you eaten them?
Oh, yeah, I eat them all the time.
Yeah, God, I hate them.
They're okay if you're starving, you know. And, but my son's in basic training right now, so he's eating 1 to 2 a day as well. But they'll keep you alive. But anybody who has to eat them long term, whether that's a week or a month or 6 months, like this gentleman I was mentioning, you know, you just, your morale, just, you're like, oh, my gosh, I got to eat that again. I mean, it gets old. And they're not exactly cheap anymore either. You know, some other things that you can do is store, I know it sounds simple, but store some spices. Because spices don't take up a lot of room. They store rather well. And they'll add some pizzazz to, you know, even if it's just rice and beans that you're storing. You know, you'll have one spice this day and a different spice another day, and you've kind of changed the meal. And I've said for years, as a means of helping people understand that the best seasoning in the whole wide world is hunger. So if you're hungry enough, food will taste good.
Yeah.
I've been there. I've been there where I haven't eaten for 3 weeks and trying to survive off the land. And, you know, food at 3 weeks in, when you haven't eaten at 3 weeks, is fantastic. It doesn't matter what it is. So, store those things up and have some spices available to help that morale, too.
Let's be a devil advocate here. Let's play a little game here, because we're going to compare and contrast our notes. People down here, everybody decides to, I've got, a 50 or 100 gallon thing of rice, and it's sealed so the roaches don't get in it, so I have it. However, rice needs to be cooked, so you need electricity or gas. It needs water, and it needs time. And that is a big deal. So up in your area, if you're doing outside wilderness, you could say you could get water from wherever your water source is. You can build a fire and you can cook it. So it's pretty good there. But if we're doing it here, you're probably, let's say if you're doing it in a neighborhood or whatever, you're not going to be able to do your charcoal grill if it's raining outside. You're not going to want to do your generator for so long to cook rice, because it'll take up all of your gas and you'll be depleted and you'll have a whole lot of fumes in your house. And furthermore, it's like, oh my gosh, my wife's hoarding the water because she wants to drink it and I'm going to use it in rice. I don't think so. So I think it's really, really important to understand who you are, where you are, and what's available to you when we're making these decisions, because it is very easy to get off kilter. MREs in your area are fabulous. MREs in my area are not. If you look at the back of them, it says exists in certain temperatures for so long. Well, the temperature I'm in, it says 1 hour. Huh. Yeah, okay. Well, I kept them underneath my bed. They're still cool. Yeah, and your electricity just went off. So there goes all your MREs, But in your area, they could last for up to 5 years or 10 years in your closet if it's cold. So it's super important. And I keep driving this home because it's very important to know your area, know your 100 miles around you. You know, is it hot? Is it cold? Is it snow? Does it flood? What does it do? And to really know that, because people, when they get used to the creature comforts, it's a whole other world when you have to take away those creature comforts, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. And, another way that I ask people to try to put this point home is when you turn the water on at your house, where does that come from?
Yeah.
And I ask kids this question all the time in school programs. Where does the water come from when you turn the water faucet on at your house? And the answers are absurd. They're absolutely absurd. Kids have no idea where their water comes from. And if nobody ever spends time teaching them, or they don't take the necessary time to study it on their own, most adults don't either. And so, if we know where our water comes from and we take the opportunity to look at a map of our area, to take a look at that 100-mile radius that you keep speaking of, then we know where other water sources could be, and we can travel to them and gather water and bring it back, or go there, utilize it for whatever we need to utilize it for, whether it's hygiene or cooking or whatever, and then go back to our shelter, even if it's at our house. But that's something that just is incredibly, incredibly vital. But people just don't know where their water sources come from.
And
most people that I ask think that that water comes from a water tower.
Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess they assume that it's manufactured there. I really don't know because I don't like to embarrass people too bad. I usually end up just letting them know, hey, if I go to another state or even I go to just another town here in Kentucky, I always know where the water source is just because I'm like you. I want to know where it is. And so when I ask that question and people tell me the water tower, I actually end up telling them, no, your water comes from this river or this creek or this reservoir or whatever. And people are surprised. There's people that are legitimately surprised to know that their water comes from a river. They think it's manufactured, I suppose, in a water tank.
Right. And I think it's really important to also note that when you have a flood and your electricity goes out, the pumping plant for the sewer and water board, that goes out too. So guess what?
Yeah.
You no longer have water coming in your pipes, and you no longer flush your toilets. Well, good luck with that. You know, if you haven't thought about these simple, simple things, surviving inside is just as bad as surviving outside. You know, you're in your own wilderness in your home because you haven't thought about anything.
And that's why I tell people, because it seems simple. The simple way is to turn the water and electric off at your house and see what happens. And I'm going to tell you, again, another thing that people come up and they tell me when they've done this and followed my advice is, Craig, I had no idea how much we poop.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I had no idea that our toilet would be, every toilet in our house would be completely full in a day. Because usually we
give it a few hours.
Yeah, we do our business and we flush and it goes down. Okay.
Right.
I can't imagine, and obviously you could share with us your experience down there during Katrina, how many people filled up their toilets in a few hours and then it couldn't go anywhere. Now we've got flies in the house landing on human excrement that is now flying around, landing on our food, landing on us, making us sick. Hygiene's out the window, we're all gonna die. I mean people are going to get sick or die.
Yeah, it's a pretty sickening situation when you bring the outdoors inside. Do you know what I mean? Because,
I like how you said that.
Yeah, it's almost like a, you know, the outdoors is great outdoors and you can breathe fresh air and you can move around and blah, blah, blah. When you bring it inside, it's sort of like bringing a bee into a glass. It gets super pissed off, you know?
Yeah.
So does everything and anything in that space. Everything you thought about your home, you turn around and, oh my God, look at that hole in that wall. Oh my gosh, look at that rug. Oh my gosh, it smells in here. Oh my gosh, you kids, you've got to go somewhere else. So in other words, everything and anything you knew as normal goes out the door. And I think that's important to understand, whether you're bringing the outside inside or whether you're trying to take your inside way in which you exist. And all of these little things, like I've got all my little kits and all my little doilies and I'm good to go, my little book and my GPS and my phone and my Google, and hey, I took notes, and we're now going to go out in the wilderness. Same thing. Indoor out or outdoor in, it doesn't work. And you really need to put it to the test to see how quickly it can fail, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, practice, you know, the quote by Colonel Cooper was, we're not going to rise to the occasion. We're going to default to our level of training. So the more you take your gear, whatever that gear is, and practice with it, and the more you eat the food that you would eat in a disaster-related event and recognize, hey, this is what – even if it's just mentally getting prepared, like, oh, man, I'm going to have to eat rice and beans or MREs or whatever it might be, you can already have a mental prep for yourself. You know, and I'll give you an example. I've been talking – in. My son graduates from basic training on Friday, so we've had phone calls with him the last 2 or 3 weeks, which is a blessing. But one of the things that, you know, came about is he has to eat so many of these MREs that, you know, they get to trading stuff. You know, my son likes peanut butter and this guy likes whatever. And so they trade. And so it's what a good instructor of mine, Ronnie Van Zandt, he runs Iron Sight Defense. He's one of my tactical instructors. Not a guy that works for me, a guy that has trained me. He talks about having little victories. And you've got to figure out a way to have these little victories to get you through your day. And in a disaster event or tragic event or whatever it might be, you need to have a little victory. And if that little victory is, hey, you know, I'll give you an example. I carry Skittles with me in my go bag. Mm-hmm. That way, in a worst-case scenario, I'm laid out and doing work, some of the work that I might have to do from time to time in a big hunk of weeds for 12 hours. I might eat a Skittle or two every now and then. And that just, you know, gives me just a tiny little boost of morale, a little victory that'll help me get through the miserableness that I'm currently experiencing. So, you know, it's little victories are vital.
Let's talk about a little victory here. And this is one no one ever talks about. In an MRE, what's the purpose of the gum? It makes you poop because otherwise, because they put so much heavy laden fiber and buildup to keep the food in your stomach to make you feel full like you've eaten a lot when you've only eaten a little bit. that it kind of like, it's almost like dropping a bomb in your stomach and it says,
yeah,
I'm going to stay here as long as I possibly can until you decide to let me out. Well, you better be chewing that gum. So many people would say, oh, I gave the gum to my kids. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It was the worst thing ever because these kids got really dehydrated then because they kept going to the bathroom. And it's like, people, pay attention. There's a purpose behind this. And, you know, and that's another really golden pellet here we're giving to you is MREs are not made for kids. Now, we understand that you're feeding them to them because there's nothing else around. But handing your kid an entire MRE kit and they're 10 years old is bad news. It's seriously bad news because, you know, kids can end up with stomach problems and impactions and all this other funky stuff. The food was not made for kids, and the gum certainly was not either. And, you know, it's really important to understand these kinds of things when people are going off randomly doing things that, oh, my friend does that. I'm good to go. I saw it on Google. We can do it. The answer is no, 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 and 100 times no, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Man, you know, I think we talk about that stuff all the time, and it's like you have to learn from experience, and boy, do you learn quick when you're in the situations, don't you think?
Yeah, and we've had so many people come to classes that bring the MREs, and they want to quote-unquote ref it or whatever.
Right.
And they, you know, one of the best ways for them to learn about that gum is to just take everybody's gum, you know. So, you know, I always offer somebody my gum out of the MRE, if depending upon how much I'm needing it, because sometimes I might need it as well. But,
right.
You know, it's a good way to learn a lesson. And it's one that's not easily forgotten either.
Yeah, and that's true. But also, I mean, you have to remember with MREs, you sometimes need extra water. So extra hydration, you know, if you're only keeping 1 gallon a person water a day, all somebody needs to say to you is, this is all we have. Or we don't have any water, and whatever you have rationed out, you will swear that they're going to drink 5 gallons in one day because in their head they said, we don't have it. And then they thought, oh, my God, whatever I have, I'm going to take it. I'm going to drink it. People instantly, if they just like when you go on a diet and they say you can't eat pizza, you can't stop thinking about the stupid stuff, you know.
Right.
So instantly, the same thing when an event happens, you're going to say, oh, my gosh, you know what? I've got it, but that's never enough. And you'll sit down the whole day and drink the whole thing, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, you know what, Craig, I think it was great to talk about all of these things because, as I've said, you know, it's about bringing wilderness in and, you know, bringing the outside, you know, switching them around. And it's like that can really challenge your life. And, hey, it really challenges your security band, you know, on how you're raising your family or how you're able to, quote, protect your family, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what it's about, is taking care of those that you care about. And, you know, I would also submit to the listener that, you know, there's this big push in the survival community, if you will, on zombies and all that craziness.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's one of the worst things that could possibly have happened is because you dehumanize. Well, zombies are not humans, and we know it. And so people do all these acts and games and TV shows and get entertained by the taking of life of a zombie because that person doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And so we play those scenarios out in our head as if that's a real scenario when in reality, the person that's going to come to your door and is seeking assistance and food is going to be something like a 12-year-old girl.
Right.
And it's not going to be some zombie that's trying to kill you and eat your brain. It's going to be a girl or a man by himself whose wife and children have been killed or whatever. And, you know, we need to be mentally prepared to handle that sort of situation. And I was teaching a class yesterday to a group of people and the discussion arose. And I think it's worthy of consideration for all of us is how far do we go to help take care of others before we're detracting from the taking care of our own.
Right.
And at the same time, how far do we ignore helping others and start becoming more like animals and not human?
Yes.
These are all things that I think we need to consider and definitely consider before it comes up because, you know, we have this mindset because, again, in my opinion, I think it's because of the zombie shows and whatnot. We'll just shoot somebody in the face if they come after our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
you're not going to shoot some 12-year-old girl in the face, right? I mean, you're just not going to do that. I mean, and if you would, you're probably losing your humanity. And so I think that's something that we need to consider. I mean, we really need to consider that now and how we would handle it so that we're prepared for it and not having to make those decisions under a fair amount of stress in the middle of that particular event.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's just about eyes wide open. I think the more times we can talk about this on the radio show, it's about alerting you. It's saying, oh, this was my experience. Oh, that was mine. You know, because people will say, I've never thought of that before. You know, here living in New Orleans, you
right.
would never think that you would get carjacked or robbed just walking down the street in the middle of the day. You know, you wouldn't think
right.
that... you know, when you send your kids off to school, that they might have problems. You know, we always like to think of the best and we hope for the best, but it's about, like you said in the beginning of the show, we need to stack up that file in our file cabinet on potentially what the potentials are. We've run through them. We kind of have a sense of them so that that can play open and that file can stay open even when you start to clamp down, you know, like you go in lockdown mode. So it's really important to have a file versus having nothing. So, Craig, it was a pleasure to have you with us here today. Can you share with the listeners how to find out about this book? Because I think that even running through this book, no matter who you are, where you are, what you do, or what you live, will give you some tips to exactly living your life whoever you are or wherever you are. It's not always just about how you can survive certain things. It's about an awareness of who you are in the world around you.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity to tell people about it. There's a couple places you can get the book. Well, there's a bunch of places you can get the book. It's at your Barnes & Noble retailer, your IndieBound. It's in a number of stores. I've seen it all over the country in Costco. But as far as an online opportunity to get it, there's two main ones. You can go to your Barnes & Noble and Amazon, what have you. You can also get it off my website, naturereliance.org. Again, the title of the book is Extreme Wilderness Survival, and my name is Craig, C-R-A-I-G, Caudill, C-A-U-D-I-L-L. That's how you look it up. So any of those retailers online or in-hand retailers will be able to serve you there, and we're happy. If you buy it from us, we always send out a couple of stickers with it and Nature Reliance School stickers, and I personally sign them as well if you buy them from us on the website.
Cool. Well, Craig, it was a pleasure to have you with us, I think, because sometimes people need to create that file in their head, and you know, there's no time like the present, let me tell you. When things are quiet, you best be paying attention. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been great. I really appreciate the opportunity.
If you'd like to find out more information about Craig Caudill, and again, his book is Extreme Wilderness Survival, and it's How to Survive Any Outdoor Situation, short-term, long-term, with or without gear, and alone or with others. I think that's very important. I'll tell you, until a situation arises and you say, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do when those words come out of your mouth, you can be able to, if you've passed through something like this book, kind of just, even I would say have the book around the house, have everybody kind of just meander through it. Someone will pick up something out of it. Someone else will read another page, and eventually it'll start the conversation going, because that's what it's all about. Conversation, experience, practicing, understanding, and having something in your head versus nothing. So please do. Do not wait till the last minute. I can tell you, I got my. When people say, "Have you ever had an adverse event?" I've got my hand up as high as it'll go. Been down that road, and let's call the PTSD cops. You know, we have all got it, but you know, that's just the way it goes. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.